This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with one of the filmmakers of the new documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry?
The FBI accused Judy Berry and Earth First of bombing themselves. Hear the true story and see the movie.
The 2012 film Lincoln, directed by Steven Spielberg, just hit theaters. We'll talk with historian Bruce Levine.
The film got a lot right, but a lot was omitted. What happened to the social forces that pushed Lincoln? What happened to the presence of African Americans?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, here at Law and Disorder, we've covered stop and frisk on a number of occasions, particularly focused on New York, where the Center for Constitutional Rights has a major lawsuit against stop and frisk. I think there's some 700,000 stop and frisks a year. Majority, of course, as you would expect in this racist city, black and Puerto Rican. There's some new news on this case.
Michael, last week, as you know, Judge Shira Shindlin, who's gone on public record as basically calling stop and frisk excessive, unconstitutional, she's going to rule in this case rather than having a jury rule in it. And the judge said that in one way it was unfortunate there wouldn't be a jury decision because then the verdict wouldn't be, as she called it, of the community. And she also noted that since she's made her views public several times, she's going to do her best to remain fair and impartial. How do you feel about her deciding this rather than a jury, Michael?
Heidi, you've asked me about the question of whether it should be a jury or a judge, but who decides that it should be a jury?
It's actually the plaintiffs in the case, that is, the people who are bringing this lawsuit. They get to decide whether they want a judge to make the decision or a jury.
I mean, they must have made a decision based on what was in the best interest of the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs themselves made the decision. That's the people who've been stopped and frisked. So presumably they chose Judge Shira Shindlin because they felt she would be a fair and honest judge in the case.
I think another possible reason might be that it would be speedier if a judge makes the decision rather than having a jury trial. It's well known that the New York City Police Department has one of the largest counterterrorism departments in the world. Now we're finding out that when cell phones are stolen, police are actually issuing subpoenas for the phone call's records from the day it was stolen onward. And they're amassing this information into a huge database.
Well, here's what's interesting. We use the word subpoena, but it doesn't go to a court. They just fill out a piece of paper and they send it over to Verizon or some phone company saying, give us all the phone records of Heidi Boghossian or Michael Smith or Michael Ratner, whoever reports their phone stolen. And what's interesting about it is that the subpoena goes to the company, and then every call that's made to that number or from that number is then given to the police department. The police department then has a giant computer database. Those numbers are fed into the enterprise case management system. And of course, they're cross-linked, hyperlinked, as the article information says, with every other phone that's ever been used or every other number, and they begin to get a pattern of the person's calls.
And as we know, as telecommunications companies are wont to do, they seem more than willing to comply with all police department requests to turn over vast volumes of call records. That we're talking AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Metro PCS. And as you've just mentioned, the police don't seek the victim's consent. So law enforcement is saying this is used to help track whoever stole the phone, but they're not asking the person whose phone was stolen for permission to get these records.
Right. That's correct, Heidi. And even worse is oftentimes your phone is stolen and you'll immediately go to the new phone company or the phone company and say, I want to get a new phone, switch my number. And then the police will be getting the phone calls to and from your new phone number.
Exactly.
No longer from the stolen phone.
That's right.
And they'll do this sometimes for a period of a couple of weeks. Now, there is one phone company that has refused, that at least asked for the victim's consent. And that company is Sprint Nextel. It requires the victim to fill out a consent form that authorized Sprint Nextel to release call records and location information to the police. So the question I'll leave our listeners with, or we'll leave our listeners with, is why aren't all the phone companies doing what Sprint Nextel does, instructed to ask the victim to fill out the consent form that authorized the subpoenas. Well, bad situation. It's just part of the huge database on all of us that is being compiled by the FBI and local police and everyone else.
And one final note is that most of these so-called stolen phone cases really never result in finding who took the phone.
So they're basically helping build up their huge database on all of us without getting any good out of it. Which brings to mind, there's a new book by Julian Assange with two or three of his associates or people who have worked with him, Jacob Applebaum, Andy Mueller-Magan, and Jeremy Zimmerman. And it's called Cypherpunks, Freedom and the Future of the Internet. It's called Cypherpunks, Freedom and the Future of the Internet. I only want to say one thing about it because it's relevant to what we're talking about with surveillance, which is that here's the Assange thesis in the book. The Assange thesis is we thought the internet was going to free us all up to do all this communication with each other, to get out all these independent voices, to do all of these things. But by its very structure, it's allowing the state to surveil every single one of us, build a database, and become more and more totalitarian, more and more controlling of our lives through surveillance and controlling our access to information and the internet, cutting off Twitter when it wants, subpoenaing records, trolling through the internet, etc. And I'm going to say this very briefly. We'll interview someone about the book hopefully soon. But Cypherpunks talks about that structure of the internet leading to totalitarianism, saying that the only way to counter that is through cryptography. Basically, all of our communications that we make with each other, that we care about, in fact, almost everything, because we probably care about everything from our locations to everything else, should be encrypted, essentially. And Assange thinks that the great hope for beating back the state totalitarianism and wiping us out through internet access is through cryptography.
And if it isn't obvious from what Michael just said, cypherpunks is the term given to activists who advocate essentially mass use of cryptography in order to protect our basic freedoms. Michael, speaking on internet surveillance, are there any cases that CCR is working on that we have updates on?
Well, you know, next week I think we'll give a fuller report as more and more of the hearings and trials have gone forward. But as people know, the center and myself represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Two of the people who are alleged to have furnished information to WikiLeaks are Jeremy Hammond, who's sitting over here in New York in Metropolitan Correction Center. And we gave a long report last week with Michael Smith on his bail hearing. And the other person is Bradley Manning, who's sitting at trial as we speak at Fort Meade. Manning's trial, which we'll report on next week, or the hearing rather, concerns what happened to him when he was held in 9 or 10 months in solitary confinement and tortured. And the lawyer for Manning is trying to get rid of the case, saying it was a pretrial punishment that's not authorized by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's illegal. It's counter to the due process. And he either wants to get the case dismissed, or he's saying that Bradley Manning's ultimate sentence should be reduced for 10 days for every day he spent in pretrial torture, essentially, which would be 2,930 days total, if you use the 10 multiplier. So that hearing's going on now. It's apparently quite intense. They've had the people from Quantico on the witness stand. And by the time we speak to you next week, it's conceivable that Bradley Manning himself will have testified. So that's the Bradley Manning case going on now. The other one, as I said, is Jeremy Hammond. Michael Smith and I talked about that last week. There was some new allegations about Jeremy Hammond recently, which is that the judge in the case, Judge Preska, apparently has some conflict in the case. Her husband is a lawyer at Cahill Gordon, a big law firm in New York, and his emails appeared on some of the Stratfor email lists that Jeremy Hammond allegedly hacked into. So the question for Judge Preska is going to be, is she going to disqualify herself because her husband's email address was hacked? We won't know that for a while. So there's a lot going on in these three cases. We bring them to your attention because while there's a lot of other cases out there on hacking and the PayPal stuff and the denial of service stuff, and there's a lot going on, these three cases represent a major effort by the U.S. to really crack down and say, we're going to control the internet. And it plays into Julian Assange's thesis that this government will do everything it can to control the internet because that's how they will control us. Who Bombed Judy Berry is a recently released documentary about the car bombing of labor and environmental organizer Judy Berry. Berry was a leader who rallied thousands of activists to camp out and protest the clear-cutting of redwood forests during the timber wars in the 1990s. Though Judy was crippled and in chronic pain from the car bomb, she went on to sue the authorities. She sued the FBI and the Oakland police for First Amendment and civil rights violations. The jury was out for 16 days and came back with a verdict of over $4.5 million. The case was tried by a heroic band of National Lawyers Guild attorneys. Judy's colleague, Daryl Cherney, who was in the car when it was bombed, is a film producer, and he joins us to talk about his new film.
Welcome, Daryl, to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here.
You produced a wonderful film, Who Bombed Judy Berry? And we wanted to start, just for listeners who may not know about Judy, by asking you to give a short update of who she was and then also why she became so dangerous to corporations.
Judy Berry was a union organizer and an Earth First organizer. She was the mother of two children, a professional carpenter, a fiddler, and a magnificent orator, a grassroots organizer extraordinaire here in the Redwood region of Northern California. She worked in her last, 10 years or so to protect ancient redwood trees as well as to unionize sawmill workers, and she did so simultaneously. And that, in a way, is what made her so dangerous to the status quo. Because in a world that we know so well as divided and conquered by, those who would have us fighting each other rather than those at the top, Judy Berry was a unifier. She was somebody who brought loggers, timber workers, mill workers, truck drivers together with environmentalists to find our common goals, our common ground, which is most of what we believe and stand for, and to focus attention rather on the corporate elites who are manipulating all of us. And she was able to do that in a way that I don't think has ever been done before.
Can you briefly describe what the issues were listeners may not know about Earth First, and then lead us through sort of the scenario of the bombing, and then we want to ask you specific questions about that?
Yes, well, the issues are the same today as if you'll allow, they've been for the last 6,000 years of recorded history. Human beings have been logging the forest since the cedars of Lebanon right up to the present day, and Judy was taking on the issue of the mowing down of ancient redwood trees that stand 350 feet tall, 15 feet wide, 2,000 years of age. And so these trees, give all of us who live here, and it is where I live here in Humboldt County, California, a sense of awe, a sense of something being larger than ourselves, as well as having great ecological value and great, scientific and historical value. A single redwood can hold 4,000 gallons of water. They're also worth about $50,000 a piece. And so you can see that the money in the redwood business is pretty large, but probably today 98% of them have been cut down. There's some of the second and third growth have come back up, but they are nowhere near the kind of forest. There's no comparison. It's like, comparing an infant to an adult. There's just no comparison as to what's going on.
Daryl, let me just ask, the time frame that we're talking about, just so that people know, sort of happened in the 80s and 90s, right?
That is correct. Certainly, these issues still continue today. But yes, Judy Berry was in Earth First. It was in its heyday, in her heyday, probably late 1980s through the mid 1990s.
Judy organized what was called Redwood Summer, and it was kind of based on Mississippi Summer back in 1963 when people went down south to help with the registration of workers. But Redwood Summer was something else. Talk to us about what Redwood Summer was and who the bad guys were and what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, Redwood Summer did emulate and imitate a Freedom Summer, sometimes called Mississippi Summer, down in the Deep South. And the strategy was the same, that as long as things happened in the Deep South without anybody else looking, they could continue. Jim Crow could continue. The lynchings could continue. And in the Redwoods, the mowing down of our ecosystem, which we believe is as much a civil rights movement as it is an environmental movement, because our ability to live on this planet depends on our ecosystem staying intact, that was going to continue on as long as nobody else was watching. And so just like in Freedom Summer, we invited college kids and anybody else who wanted to come to participate. And that is what Redwood Summer was.
Daryl, since you were there, we'd like to hear sort of the personal account of, I understand that through protests and fights against corporate cutting down of the trees, there were threats made against you and Judy. How did that feel? How did this lead up to the actual bombing? And were there other incidents that made you fearful?
Yes. We received probably about three dozen death threats, mostly by letter, but some by phone and some even in person, over a very short period of time, about a month and a half, right after we announced Redwood Summer. So starting in April of 1990 through the time that we were car bombed in May of 1990. And we kept all these threats in folders. We turned them into the police. I even called the FBI itself at one point. So this was something that was known in the newspapers and known to law enforcement. So Judy and I were really tense. I was scared not just for myself, but I was more scared for Judy because she was a person that I loved dearly, and I couldn't really imagine the world without her. And so we decided to do a tour to actually get out of Dodge because we mistakenly assumed that the threats were mostly going to be the most dangerous in our local areas, in the rural logging areas of Humboldt and Mendocino counties. So as we were touring universities, Santa Cruz, Cal State Sacramento, I can give you a laundry list of the colleges on our schedule. As we were leaving Oakland, where Judy had spent the night, heading towards Santa Cruz about just before 12 noon, I got into her car, and may I say that there were two cars I could have ridden in that day. I was a passenger at that particular moment. So I chose to get, or Judy ordered me into her car. So it was sort of a happenstance, a twist of fate, if you will, that I got into Judy Barry's passenger seat. As we drove for literally just a couple of minutes, if not or less, a bomb exploded under her seat, almost killing her, fracturing her pelvis, causing intestinal damage, pulverizing her lower vertebrae. She was really almost killed. And by some miracle, I was only slightly injured sitting right next to her and the bomb. It was a big, 2.5 foot long, foot and a half wide hole through the sheet metal floorboard. And I would say instantly, really just within 5 minutes, the FBI and Oakland Police showed up, but the FBI in particular, and announced that we were terrorists who were guilty of having our own bomb explode on us. May I say that they knew immediately that the bomb was a booby trap. It had a motion trigger designed to only go off in a moving car. They looked at the death threats and immediately dismissed them as irrelevant. They, right at the beginning, decided, as our lawsuit against the FBI said, that Dennis Cunningham, National Lawyers Guild of the Year attorney, at one point wrote, he said it was just the FBI was around the corner holding their ears.
Judy made it a point of having all the people she organized come to Redwood Summer take a pledge of nonviolence. Why was that?
Well, a number of reasons. One, you can't bring thousands of people to mass actions and have a bunch of wingnuts or just violent people show up, haphazardly and disrupt things for everybody else. I say that violence is a dominant gene. You can have, 1,000 peaceful people, but one violent person can ruin it for everybody else. And so we as organizers took a firm stance, and I really recommend this for a lot of other mass organizing groups, to institute a nonviolence code right off the bat. Now, Earth First did have a history of advocating sabotage in defense of the environment. In our movie, there's somebody who says, well, destruction of equipment may be wrong, but destruction of the environment is equally as wrong. And so the Earth First movement added a whole new spice, a new flavor. And at the time, we became the darlings of the media by becoming the living incarnation of the Monkey Wrench Gang. Now, it wasn't as if we were personally or anybody we knew was sabotaging equipment, but certainly it was in the newspaper. It was in the songs we wrote and sang. It was on the T-shirts we wore. You could say that we were modern-day Luddites who just had disdain for the machinery of destruction. So that was another reason to call for the nonviolence code, to make sure people understood that this was not an invitation for the Monkey Wrench Gang to show up.
Now, when you and Judy were accused by the FBI, as you say, just minutes after the bombing, of having planted the bomb, I don't know if we want to give away everything that happens in the film, because it gets really interesting with what the FBI did and did not make public, which goes to the lawsuits. Were you surprised that the FBI accused you?
Well, I was shocked, but in the end, not surprised. I was actually reading, at that particular time, Ward Churchill's Agents of Repression, which gave a whole comprehensive history of the FBI's counterintelligence program, their COINTELPRO program. So as soon as they accused me, really, just very shortly after the bombing, they just said, look, we can tell if this is your bomb, so why don't you just confess, make it easy on all of us, and get it over with. As soon as they said that, I immediately thought of Leonard Peltier. I thought of Geronimo Pratt Chijaga. I thought of all the people, the Puerto Rican independence movement. I thought of all the people that I had just read about, which is why education in the environmental, actually in the activist movement, is so important, so we understand that history does have a tendency to repeat itself. So, no, I wasn't surprised, but I was shocked and I was pissed. And I let them know it. And I, of course, as soon as they said that, the first thing I said was, I want to see my lawyer.
That's the first thing everybody should say. Frank Doyle, the FBI agent who was involved in COINTELPRO stuff prior to that, particularly with Geronimo Pratt, what role did he play in this disaster?
Well, you know, first we have to say that it was Richard Held, who was a famous, you know, or infamous COINTELPRO operative. He and his father, there was a Richard Held Sr. and a Jr., they were both worked under J. Edgar Hoover, and they specialized in disrupting political movements. In particular, Richard Held, who was in charge of the San Francisco Bureau, which was in charge of our case, personally saw to it that Geronimo Pratt was put into prison ultimately for 27 years on false charges before he was ultimately freed and given $4 million by the FBI for false imprisonment. So there's the same guy in charge of Pratt's case, the same guy who led the manhunt for Leonard Peltier across the Canadian border, the same guy who was in charge of our case. So it was a political operative. Now, Frank Doyle was working under him as the chief of the terrorism division in San Francisco, and he taught a bomb school every year, I do believe. And in this particular bomb school, it took place in Humboldt County. The FBI rented land from the Louisiana Pacific. And the more I learned, the more I realized that the FBI had an ongoing relationship, certainly beyond just renting land from the lumber company, but they rented the lumber company land to blow up cars with pipe bombs as part of a police academy course that was offered at College of the Redwoods. So here they are blowing up cars with pipe bombs, putting the bombs on the inside of the car. If the bomb is on the inside of the car, then the occupants must be guilty. So they essentially recreated the bomb scene just 30 days teaching bomb school with Frank Doyle before it happened. And then when the bomb went off, there's Frank Doyle with one of his students, and he points at the car on FBI video, his own voice, and he says, this is the final exam.
You remind us of also the false memo that was later found out to be issued by the FBI on Earth First letterhead. Can you talk about that briefly?
Well, I certainly want to issue blame where it's due. And those false press releases were ultimately issued by a lumber company, for lack of a better word, interest group. They were not issued by the FBI, although those people in the lumber company certainly worked happily with the FBI, but they were actually people working in the lumber industry. And it was a woman whose DNA we actually got off of one of the fake press releases, named Candy Boak of Boak Logging. That's a proven fact. Who was involved along with some other people in sending out these fake press releases. But what they did, the press releases said we were violent, and they were distributed in lumber companies' sawmills, in the laundromats, so that there were, and none of us saw them until eventually one filtered down to us through the press. So those were definitely part of a hate campaign, definitely designed to take a very, very tense situation and really pour gasoline on the embers and blow the whole thing up.
Heidi had mentioned the lawsuit, which was quite an extraordinary achievement. We wanted to talk to you about that. What was the FBI and the Oakland police accused of doing, and what happened as a consequence of the lawsuit?
Well, the FBI and the Oakland police ultimately were found liable, which is a civil term for guilty. So they were found guilty of violating the First Amendment of the Constitution, And that was pretty much the primary charge, and that was that they knew we were innocent. It wasn't that they were mistaken. It was that they absolutely knew that we were innocent. I mean, they found the motion trigger that said the bomb can only go off in a moving vehicle. They said nails in the bomb matched nails in the back of Judy's car. Well, Judy was a carpenter, but the nails in the back of her car were roofing nails, and the nails strapped to the bomb were finishing nails. They were no more identical than a Rolls Royce and a Volkswagen are identical just because they're cars. So you've got them lying, and the jury is listening to these lies. They never conducted any investigation at all. They didn't take, even in our case, even if they wanted to prove we were guilty, they never asked Judy a single question, and they could have questioned her any time. We both stepped forward with our attorneys and said we will be happy to meet with the FBI or Oakland police I wanted to file a police report that somebody tried to kill us. That didn't seem to be an option. So right to the day of her death, the FBI and Oakland police never asked Judy Barry one question, even though they could have taken her deposition because we sued them. They could have taken her deposition as early as a year after the bombing. They never had any interest, and when she finally gave her deposition on her deathbed, they did not have any questions for her. We were Dennis Cunningham, our attorney, was the only person who had questions. However, they did, and this is not in the movie, object to Judy's answers approximately 350 times. Yes, we counted. 350 times in order to disrupt her from being able to answer the questions that our own attorney was asking her, because they didn't want the jury to hear Judy Barry speak eloquently and fluently.
Can you clarify when they were objecting? Was that when Dennis was taking the deposition? She was in the hospital room, or she was. We should let listeners know she was dying of cancer.
Yes, our movie is framed Who Bombed Judy Barry, which, by the way, people can see on whobombedjudybarry.com. Who Bombed Judy Barry is framed around Judy Barry's deathbed deposition because she was not going to live to see our civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland police. She's not going to live to see it to trial. She had to give her testimony on camera. And we take that on-camera testimony and allow her to narrate her own story. Who Bombed Judy Barry is narrated by Judy Barry. And so what we don't show in the movie, because it just wasn't either interesting or it didn't make for a good movie, but people should know, the FBI interrupted her at every juncture. You know, who was in the car with you? Well, the answer is Gerald Cherney. But all that calls for speculation, you know? Yeah. They didn't allow, I'm surprised they didn't object when she gave her name. You know, they objected to every single thing she said.
That's extraordinary. We didn't know that from watching the movie because it was edited out, because she just does a wonderful job, as weak as she was, kind of laying back on that couch, a wonderful job of describing what kind of political organization she had created and what they accomplished and how she was framed up for trying to exercise her First Amendment rights in organizing against these powerful corporations. Just an extraordinary movie, Daryl. Really, we congratulate you for having the fortitude to do this. Talk some more, will you, about Judy Barry. You know, we all knew about her living in New York, but we weren't ever present at any of her talks or what she was organizing because we were a continent away. But she emerges as one of the great heroines in the American left from this movie. Talk to us more about her, would you?
Judy Barry spoke in plain language, but she issued profound thoughts. And I think that one of Judy Barry's special abilities was to be able to speak to the working class of which she was a member. Judy Barry was a working carpenter, a full-time carpenter. In fact, she called herself a foreman. She was a foreman at California Yurts, and she supervised the construction crew. So Judy Barry was no stranger to hard work, to working with wood, no less. So she related to the logger. She was able to say things like, she would say, well, a logger may make the first cut, and a mill worker might make the second cut, but the person who publishes the Earth First Journal is making the third cut. You know, she totally drew the line. She said the greenhouse effect will give us wonderful weather to watch the end of the world by. She was just the kind, she had a great sense of humor, and she was the kind of person who just spoke to the every person. And when she spoke, thousands came to hear her. She motivated people. She was also a great organizer. I mean, she kept the mailing list. She did the fundraising. She sat at the T-shirt table. She got, arrested in doing civil disobedience. She organized the largest mass arrest in the Forest Movement's history. I think only one anti-nuclear movement had more arrests in a single day. There was 1,033 arrested. She got Bonnie Raitt and other celebrities, Ed Begley Jr., to come and join us. But mostly, she had a radio show on two radio stations, as a matter of fact, up here in Mendocino and Humboldt. So I think Judy Barry's strongest attribute was her oratory. I call her our Martin Luther King of the Redwoods.
And she played the violin, and I will never forget that scene where you're making a presentation, I think, with officials in a sort of stuffed shirt room, and she brings out the violin, and people just stare. It was quite beautiful.
Daryl, yes. How can people see the film and say it slowly and repeat it?
Well, our schedule is on whobombedjudybarry.com. That's JudyBarry.com. We're actually doing a one-week benefit for Pacifica and KPFK in Los Angeles, December 7th through 13th at the NoHo 7 Theater in North Hollywood. That's all on our schedule. And we'll be back at the Long Island Film Festival in the New York area around the end of February, beginning of March. Again, just go to our schedule at whobombedjudybarry.com.
Thank you, Daryl, and you have all our support.
Best of luck to you, Daryl.
Great job, Daryl. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. But his soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hanged him for a traitor, they themselves the traitor crew. His soul goes marching on.
The recent film Lincoln hit the theaters this fall. The film recounts how President Abraham Lincoln succeeded in getting the 13th Amendment, which freed slaves, through the House of Representatives in 1865. Lincoln was expecting the Civil War to end within a month, but concerned his 1863 Emancipation Proclamation would be discarded by the courts once the war ended and the 13th Amendment defeated by the returning slave states. In the film, we see Lincoln working to pass the amendment. We talk today with Civil War historian Professor Bruce Levine, who gives some perspective on the movie, the strength and the weaknesses of Lincoln, how he grew, what was at stake, and what social forces impelled Lincoln to get the 13th Amendment passed. Bruce Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Mike.
Bruce, the Lincoln movie has been in the theaters now, quite popular and getting some acclaim, and you went to the movie as we did. Bruce, what did you think about the movie, good and bad?
Well, you know, there are artistic reactions and then there's substantive historical reactions. I suppose you're not asking me for my artistic take, so let me talk about what it has to say about its subject. I have really mixed feelings about it. On the strong side, it's a Civil War movie that, unlike so many others, properly places slavery and the Republican Party's determination to see slavery die at the center of the story. And that makes it very valuable. You may know that in a poll not so long ago, a near majority of the population registered its view that the Civil War was not especially caused by slavery. And that the proportion is even higher among people under 30 years of age. So putting slavery at the center of a story about the Civil War, where it appropriately belongs is a very good thing and a very important accomplishment on the part of this movie. On the other hand, I think the movie is deficient in a number of ways. And I'm not talking about small details, because nobody expects or should expect commercial film to hew immediately to the line of historical accuracy. It's enough if it gives, I think, an overall accurate sense of its subject. But this one leaves out some major historical context, and the result is, I think, to somewhat distort a viewer's understanding of what really was going on at the time. There are key parts of this actual story that are missing. The prior course of the war, the growth of anti-slavery sentiment in the Union, especially the important role that slaves and former slaves and legally free black people played in advancing both the Union war effort and the struggle against slavery, and actually who initiated the idea of the 13th Amendment, among others.
Bruce, this is Michael Ratner.
Hi.
I mean, I saw the movie a few days ago. My impression of the movie, apart from the artistic merits or demerits, was that Lincoln was this incredibly courageous guy. He decided that he had to get the 13th Amendment through, that he pushed it. He had to push around the abolitionists a bit. He had to push around the Democrats a lot. And it made him into, you know, the hero that everybody would say, well, why isn't Obama doing what Lincoln did?
Exactly.
Now, what's wrong with the perception that most people have, including a bunch of us who went to the film and said, boy, he was a great guy, great president?
Well, let me start by saying that I think he was a really great president. I think this was by far the best president ever sitting in the White House. I'm not sure, considering who he's competing against, how much that says.
No, but that's important to say. That's very important to recognize that despite the critiques of a lot of people, that he was a great president. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's perfectly okay. I think he really was. I think this was a tremendous individual. And if, as is said of other presidents as well, if it is said of Lincoln that he grew into his role, I think that's certainly true. I don't think if you looked at Abraham Lincoln in 1850, you'd have any idea he would be capable of what he proves to be capable of once he's elected.
Well, Wendell Phillips, the Boston abolitionist, said they had to water him in order for him to grow into it.
Well, Phillips, you know, in this respect is partly right. The context did help Lincoln, and the role of the radical Republicans, in whose ranks Lincoln, of course, did not stand, which was led by people like Thaddeus Stevens, who does appear in the film, was crucial in shaping events in this era. So, for example, it wasn't Lincoln who came up with the idea of the 13th Amendment. In fact, Lincoln opposed the idea until around the time of the summer 1864 Republican National Convention. It was abolitionists and radical Republicans who started pushing for that idea in the spring of 1863. And as I say, it takes Lincoln a long time to come around to the idea that this is a good one. It is also true, though, that once he does, Lincoln then does push it quite hard, as is shown in the film, and in this respect, the film is accurate. Among other things that's missing, though, is the understanding that compromise and political manipulation was not at the heart of the success of Lincoln's presidency. On the contrary, what was wonderful about what Lincoln did was the number of times he refused to compromise. On all the essentials, Lincoln did not compromise. So, for example, just before the presidential election, there was tremendous pressure to water down the Republican platform, which opposed the expansion of slavery into the vast federally owned territories. Water down that platform in order to attract more votes. Well, Lincoln absolutely refused to do that, got elected anyway. After his election and the states of the Cotton South start to secede, there's again tremendous pressure on Lincoln and his party to back away from the platform on which it had just been elected in order to bring the cotton states back in and mollify those slave states that were still within the Union. Again, Lincoln absolutely refused to do that. When Fort Sumter was besieged by the Confederacy, there was tremendous pressure echoed within Lincoln's cabinet by his own Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, to abandon the fort and withdraw. Once again, Lincoln absolutely refused to do that. That string of uncompromising stands is what brought on the war. Now, there are some who think that fact proves the weakness of Lincoln's presidency. A new book just appeared that says just that. This uncompromising stance was a fault of Lincoln's because it brought on the war. Well, this uncompromising stance is what ultimately led to the abolition of slavery, along with a number of other factors. And so what we should be, I think, recognizing as Lincoln's greatness was not his ability to bend, not his ability to give in, not his ability to concede, but his refusal to do that at most of the important points on which he was challenged.
Now, let me go back to what I said about the impression of the film for a second, Bruce, because as you started this conversation, you said, well, it was a lot more that was going on than just Lincoln deciding he wanted the 13th Amendment. There were lots of forces at work pushing for that. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Almost as soon as the states of the Deep South started to leave the Union, parts of the slave population began to recognize that a new opportunity had been created for them to take an initiative in liberating themselves and hopefully doing away with slavery as a whole. And so they begin evading, escaping from their masters and making their way to Union lines and Union fortifications. This actually starts even before the war begins. Initially, the reaction of the Union Army and even the Republican Party is to refuse to allow those fugitives inside Union forts and behind Union lines. The Republican Party begins the war, and Lincoln does too, swearing that this is not a war about slavery, it is a war about Union, and it does that because it's trying simultaneously to retain the support for the war among Northern Democrats, who are not especially anti-slavery, to put it mildly. And they're also hoping that they can bring the seceding states back into the Union quickly. They're under the illusion that the majority of the white population of the Deep South is not really disloyal. It's just been outmaneuvered by a handful of secessionist extremists and maybe thinks the Republican Party as a whole, if we do nothing to anger this would-be loyal majority, such as tinkering with slavery during the war, we can bring them all back into the Union quickly and relatively quietly with very little bloodshed. And so when slaves begin to liberate themselves, the Union initially doesn't want any part of that. But before very long, this process makes Union officers, at least some of them, recognize an important fact, and that is that slave labor is a crucial element of the Confederacy's strength. It's slaves who are raising the crops and feeding the population and the armies, slaves who are building the fortifications for the armies. In fact, at Fort Monroe, at the tip of the Virginia Peninsula, three slaves present themselves in the spring of 1861 who were about to be sent precisely to work on Confederate fortifications, and they instead escape from their master, present themselves to the fort's commander, and offer to work for him and his army. And the general there, Benjamin Butler, recognizes that there's something valuable, something important going on here. A crucial element of strength of the Confederacy is withdrawing itself from the Confederacy, and even better, presenting itself to the Union as a potential source of strength. And Butler lets them in. And that is the beginning of a change in Union policy. This kind of thing takes place throughout the South. And it is instrumental in making the Republican Party and the Union Army understand that not only is slavery the cause of the war, but breaking slavery down is a necessary element in winning the war for the Union.
Bruce, I'm curious, were historians consulted when Steven Spielberg was getting ready and preparing to work on this film?
Well, I'm told that some were. I don't know the details of that, I'm afraid.
Bruce, let's talk about to continue your thought about the participation of blacks in the war. There were some 38,000 black former slaves that became troops in the Union Army. And what's your opinion on the effect that they had?
Well, it's actually much bigger than 38,000. By the end of the Civil War, closer to 200,000 black men had served either as Union soldiers or sailors. 200,000. That's about twice as big, almost in absolute numbers, as any army that the Confederacy ever fielded throughout the course of the war. I'm happy to follow the often expressed view that Lincoln made of their contribution to the Union victory. Lincoln said over and over again in answer to people who objected to enlisting black soldiers, he said, "We cannot give up this source of strength. Do that and we lose the war, guaranteed. Without the what he called the colored force, the Union," said Lincoln, "had no chance of defeating the Confederacy." And I think that's an accurate assessment.
Bruce, step back for a second. Talk about the social forces that were involved. What did Lincoln represent? What did Lincoln represent? You know, he was the common view of him is that he's this guy that's chopping wood in the backwoods in Illinois. But as a matter of fact, he was in one of the top law firms in the capital of the state of Illinois, and he was representing corporations and railroad companies. And what were the social forces behind the Republican Party when the Civil War started?
Well, historians have certain disagreements about this this question. I'll tell you my view, and I think naturally because it's my view, I think it's the right one. I think what Lincoln represents is a sort of de facto coalition of people ranging from skilled workers to small shopkeepers and small to middling employers in the North, who are fervently attached to the idea that labor ought to be legally free and that enslaved labor is a moral, political, and economic disaster, not just for the South, but for the country as a whole. This great middle of the Northern population has been slowly moving toward a more and more strongly anti-slavery position since about, well, really over the course of 40 years preceding the Civil War. These are forces that strongly believe in what they call free labor society, we would call capitalism. And it's important to recognize that in the middle of the 19th century, capitalism is a different animal than it is at the beginning of the 21st century. It's, in many ways, still a revolutionary force in the world and has to fight for its right to exist and to survive and to triumph over other older forms of society like slavery and serfdom and other forms of bound labor. So a lot of the most radical members of the Republican Party, Thaddeus Stevens is again a good example, think of them, and appropriately so, think of themselves as revolutionaries in the vanguard of progress in the world. And I think that's what the Republican Party represents in the United States in the 1850s and 1860s. It's the most politically progressive, pro-democratic, small-d advocate of free labor capitalism.
Bruce, one of the critiques of the film was the absence of African Americans, slaves, blacks. They were in the gallery in one of the scenes. They came in when they finally, I guess the House passed the 13th Amendment. Then, of course, there was one of them in a relationship with Thaddeus Stevens, apparently. Very little other presence of blacks, no Frederick Douglass. What do you think that made viewers miss in the film? Do you think it was an oversight? Do you think it was important? What was your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a very important oversight, Michael. It makes black people seem effectively as bystanders in this struggle. And that's a misconception that has been perpetuated for many, many decades in the United States. It's a misconception, it's worth saying, that professional historians abandoned approximately 30 years ago, but it's one that still grips the popular imagination and is unfortunately reinforced in this movie. They appear, just as you say, in this movie as symbols of a problem rather than as people actively intervening in history to solve that problem. This is a common mistake in much popular imagery and popular culture. We worship heroes. We worship presidents overall. We give all our attention to a handful of people regarded as geniuses and near geniuses. The people who built America, as one unfortunately titled TV series now refers to a group of economic pioneers, manufacturers, and so on. If there's one story in American history that proves that you can't have leaders, even very good leaders, without active supporters, supporters who, in the case of Lincoln, often pointed the way to Lincoln before he decided to move in that direction, it's the Civil War. And again, Black people, enslaved and free, were crucial to the evolution of this war. It was because of their situation that the war began, and it was because, largely at least, what they did that the war ended the way it did. As I said earlier, the role that they play in the Union armies, especially in the second half of the war, is absolutely crucial to the outcome. I don't think you'd know that from this film, and that's very unfortunate.
Bruce, I actually haven't yet seen the film, but I know that Lincoln was known to have said earlier that Blacks were inferior to whites, and if freed, they should go back to Africa. Did the film touch on that at all?
I don't remember the film addressing that subject squarely. It's worth noting that Lincoln holds to the position that emancipated Blacks ought to go back to Africa until about the middle of the war. After he issues the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 1863, he doesn't talk about that. He doesn't advocate that publicly ever again. That reflects an aspect of Lincoln's political and intellectual evolution. This really is somebody who, as we said earlier, grew during his presidency. He grew intellectually, and he grew politically, and he grew morally. And by the end of the war, Lincoln is not only no longer talking about colonization, and that was the word used for voluntarily, that was the word used to refer to the process by which emancipated Blacks would voluntarily leave the country for some other part of the world, the policy that Lincoln, like so many others before him, advocated. He's not only abandoned that by the end of the war, but he's also urging that at least some Black men be given the right to vote. And in fact, it's a speech to that effect that evidently pushes John Wilkes Booth over the edge and makes him swear that he's going to kill Lincoln.
We're speaking with Professor Bruce Levine, who's the J.G. Randall Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Illinois. Bruce has a new book coming out called The Fall of the House of Dixie. Bruce, tell us a little bit about what your book is and how it impacts on this movie.
Fall of the House of Dixie attempts to tell the story that the revolutionary aspect of the American Civil War. We mostly know this and celebrate this if we celebrate this as a war to save the Union. Most Americans who think of themselves as Civil War enthusiasts are people who genuinely know the military side, or at least part of the military side of the war. Fall of the House of Dixie tells the story of the Civil War as a social and political revolution, and tries to take a reader through the process by which slavery began to break down during the course of the war. So it starts emphasizing that this was a war brought on by a conflict over slavery, and then demonstrates that in the course of the war, slavery itself began to break down under the burden of combat and what it takes to sustain combat on the Confederacy side. It also points to cracks in the facade of white unity within the Confederacy. Although the majority of Southern whites apparently remain ardent supporters of the Confederacy down through the last months of the war, important segments of the white South oppose the creation of the Confederacy to begin with, and others begin to abandon their support for the Confederacy as the costs of the war mount and as the perception grows that poorer Southern whites are bearing a disproportionate share of the burden of carrying the war forward compared to those who stand to benefit most from the Confederacy's survival, the slave owners.
If you conceive of the American Revolution in 1776 as a war of independence from England, and you conceive of the Civil War as actually a war that ended slavery and extended capitalism across the continent, I suppose you would call the Second American Revolution. Going in that direction, what would you call the third one?
The third revolution, obviously, is one that would still be in our future. And it would be, I imagine, a revolution that would do away with the social ills that have been created in this society, precisely by the economic system that was playing a revolutionary role in the 19th century. Abraham Lincoln wouldn't have recognized the world that came into being partly as a result of the Union victory, even by the late 19th century. The drastic increase in inequality, the immiseration of people who, while legally free, are still entirely dependent for their survival on low wages paid to them in exchange for exhausting work, much less would he recognize the world we live in today.
Bruce Levine, we want to thank you for being with us, Professor Bruce Levine, discussing the Lincoln movie, and of course, briefly, but later on, we'll have more on Bruce Levine and his new book, Fall of the House of Dixie. Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you, Bruce.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.